welcome to At the Letters for the 19th of March, 2024. Ben Nicholson-Smith here with you in Toronto, and I am joined by Arden Zwelling in Clearwater, Florida, as we speak. Arden, good morning. How's it going?
Hey, man. Good morning. Things are going well. How you doing?
Good, good, good. Got back to Toronto a few days ago, and the Jays have only sustained like 3 injuries since then, so not the greatest few days of developments for the Toronto Blue Jays. We're going to get into all of that here on ATL today, which is produced by Christian Ryan and by Nick Andrade. So thanks to them for producing. Thanks to you for listening. Just 1 week until opening day, a week and a couple days here as we record this on Tuesday, March 19th. So yeah, it is crunch time. And since we last spoke, Arden, the Jays have dealt with a number of injuries. I mean, Danny Jansen has a broken bone in his hand that's going to sideline him for a couple weeks. But let's start with the news that we just heard come out of Blue Jays camp this morning, which is that Jordan Romano is dealing with some right elbow inflammation. He is getting an anti-inflammatory injection. And meanwhile, Eric Swanson dealing with some right forearm tightness and technically no injury or structural damage in either case. But this is not good news for the Blue Jays.
No, it's not what you want, particularly when Kevin Gausman and Alek Manoah are already dealing with their own ailments. And then obviously Danny Jansen as well, who we'll talk about later. We should probably keep an eye on Tim Mayza. Last time we saw him in a game, like the velo was down. He didn't look particularly comfortable on the mound. Sounds like his next outing is actually going to be in a minor league game. So that is another one to keep an eye on. So yeah, the Blue Jays dealing with just myriad issues right now in their pitching staff.
Yeah, so at this point we haven't heard from Jordan Romano, from Eric Swanson. We don't know exactly what sort of timetable we're looking at, but you know, clearly as you look at this in just a general sense, typically if you're getting an injection, I mean, there's going to be a period of rest that follows from that. You're not going to hop on the mound the next day. You're not going to be in a game the next day. And we are talking about a timeline here where we're 9 days away from games that count against the Tampa Bay Rays in regular season play. So I think it's fair to say at this point with both Swanson and with Jordan Romano, it's at least a question as to their availability. And I'm not going to try to read the tea leaves too much beyond that. But as you look at things right now, it's at least hard to say those guys are the locks that we probably assumed they were for that opening day roster.
Yeah, relievers are tough because their ramp ups can be expedited in a way that a starter's ramp up can't be because they only throw an inning and they may only throw 20, 30 pitches in an outing. But look, even if these guys are ready for opening day, which obviously is very seriously in question at this point, they're not going to be ready for back-to-backs and they're not going to be ready for very extended outings. And you are opening the season with 7 games in 7 days when you know, you hope to have some leads that you are looking to protect, and you're going to be wanting to use these guys. Like, this is your you know, your best and second best high leverage reliever in your bullpen. So even if you have them on the roster and you you know, use them on opening day or second day of the season, that means they're likely not going to be available the day following. And if they have a particularly extended outing, might not be available for 2 days following. So this is just going to put additional pressure on guys like Jimmy Garcia and Chad Green and Yenesis Cabrera, Tim Mayza, Trevor Richards, the other pitchers in the Blue Jays bullpen who are going to have to step up to fill those absences at the beginning of the season.
For sure. And, you know, I think that even in an outcome where, okay, let's say they need a little bit of time or they're just still somewhat ramping up, as you say, maybe they're not ready for back-to-backs, they could still be ready shortly into the season. So this is not necessarily a doomsday situation, but if those guys need a little bit of time to ramp up, I think we're probably looking at, hey, the Jays are up 4-2 against the Rays on the second day of the season. They need someone to close the game out. Like, I think Chad Green and Jimmy Garcia probably are those guys. Maybe a Tim Mayza in that mix if he is, you know, full bore at that point. But to me, I'm kind of looking at Green and Jimmy Garcia, and I know it's not just about saves, and there's so much more to a bullpen than just who is that capital C closer, but I would probably look to Green and Garcia as those guys.
At that point, roles are just like out the window. Without a Romano and a Swanson, I think it's just whatever the matchups are from the sixth inning on. And remember, like even in their first starts of the season, guys like a Berríos, a Bassett, a Kikuchi, like these aren't guys who you're going to be asking to throw 110 pitches in their first outing of the season. You're going to want to be conservative with them as well, and not really burn these guys out in the first week of April. So you're probably going to be going to your bullpen like pretty early. Like, what's one thing that Tampa Bay Rays lineup can do? It can be pesky, and it can foul off a bunch of pitches, and it can like really execute an approach. Same thing with the Houston Astros and some of the hitters that they feature, the selectivity and discipline and patience that they have up and down their lineups. So you might be going to your bullpen pretty early, and so I think that's just going to come down to John Schneider, Pete Walker, all the folks who are involved in those decisions, just targeting the matchups, the pockets of the batting order that they want to get guys against. And it might be sometimes like guys who entering spring training, maybe you weren't thinking about trusting in leverage situations that present themselves in even the seventh inning, but it's like, hey, Zach Pop sinker like matches really well against these upcoming three hitters in the Astros batting order. In he goes on April 1st to try to retire some very good hitters, a guy who, you know, really wasn't even in the opening day bullpen projection midway through spring.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Pop, Pearson, Little, these are guys who have been on the edge of that bullpen competition, and maybe they get pushed a little further in to the point that they're breaking camp, to the point that they are taking on some pretty big innings with this team, which, you know, we all knew it was going to happen at some point in the season. That is par for the course in the course of a long year. I don't think anyone really expected it to be quite this early. When you looked at this bullpen for much of spring training, there weren't really a ton of questions about performance, about what kind of results they're capable of getting, even composition. You got a couple lefties, you got a bunch of righties, you got guys with experience, you've got, you know, a really good mix of pitchers in there. And then here we are, 9 days remaining until opening day. It's a tough one. It really is a tough one for this team. And I think it almost highlights the importance of, you know, a guy like Trevor Richards, who we don't talk about, but then Mitch White might be the number five, which we'll get to in a second here. So Richards might be piggybacking off of him. And then 2 days later, you might be going to him because you need to bridge the fifth and the sixth inning on a day that, you know, Kikuchi's pitch count gets elevated early. Like, you are going to need, it is going to be an all hands on deck situation if even one of Romano or Swanson needs some time on the sidelines.
Yeah, and this is what a lot of teams are dealing with across baseball. Like, you can honestly just pull up any roster resource page across the league, and you're going to find a bunch of dudes under the injured list on the pitcher side, because it's spring training, right? Like, pitchers who just have, you know, they've been throwing over the offseason, certainly, and playing long toss and maybe the odd bullpen session, things like that. But I mean, these are guys who have not really ramped it up, like not really thrown very high intensity, max effort, like I am trying to strike your ass out pitches in a while. So that's putting, you know, somewhat of a novel stress on their bodies that hasn't been experienced in a matter of months. So that's when things get cranky, to borrow a term from Alek Manoah. That's when, you know, you start experiencing soreness and tightness and inflammation, and you're not bouncing back quite as well in between outings. You know, you see the most, like the highest concentration of injuries right at the beginning of spring training, throughout spring training, and then right out of the All-Star break. Like, that's when you typically see a lot of injuries, because like just players have been down for a while and they haven't been in their rhythms and routines, and their bodies are just not quite accustomed to the stresses that players put them under throughout a regular season, because they've been off for a little bit. So, you know, just this is not, you know, unique to the Blue Jays. It's not novel to the Blue Jays. If anything, the health they had last year was unique and novel and unusual. You know, this is something that the Blue Jays are going to have to deal with, just as 29 other teams are going to have to deal with. It's why you try to build as much organizational pitching depth as humanly possible.
Yeah, you can never have enough, that's for sure, and becomes apparent every single year. You mentioned Alek Manoah and his word of choice there that he used in conversation with me late last week in Florida when I spoke to him. And let's get to the rotation a little bit, because, you know, I do think that these guys have been focuses of camp the entire time, and rightfully so, when it comes to Kevin Gausman and Alek Manoah and what their progression looks like. And at this point, so that was, I want to say it was Wednesday of last week that I spoke to Manoah, and he said, hey, it just didn't feel right. He's still hopeful, or was hopeful at that point, of getting off a mound early this week. So that would be right around now. So I guess before I continue, have you heard anything to indicate that he is definitively going to be off a mound at any point?
Yes, he is going to be off a mound here on Tuesday, March 19th, as we record. He's going to throw a side session, or at least he's scheduled to. I don't know for sure that he has thrown it, but scheduled to throw a side session. Okay. I would be surprised if he didn't throw that side session. So he will be off a mound here this week.
Everything is in line then as far as what he was hoping to do and where that is landing at the moment. So here we are, March 19th. Typically, you're looking at a 4 to 5 to 6 week buildup from the point that a pitcher really gets off a mound. And remember, at this point, it's been a long layoff. It's been almost 3 weeks since he was actually pitching off a mound before, because that was the end of February. So it is actually 3 weeks that have gone by. That is enough that whatever he had built up before is kind of out the window. He is in the midst now of a new buildup. And the Blue Jays aren't going to phrase it this way, but essentially, he is going to need minimum a month, probably closer to 5, maybe 6 weeks. So you're looking at end of April in a very good case situation for Alek Manoah being stretched out to a 5-inning pitcher. That's just the workload standpoint. You still have the questions around command and execution and delivery, all those things. But just from the standpoint of workload, that's where he's at. So, you know, that is one spot in this rotation that is, at this point, there's no longer any ambiguity. He will not be ready to open the season.
Yeah, and he likely won't be at a big league level until at the very earliest mid-April. But realistically, like, they're going to get him built up, and then they're going to send him on a minor league rehab assignment, and they're probably going to utilize the majority of their 30 days on that minor league rehab assignment just to kind of get him in the rhythm and hopefully get him getting some good results and feeling confident. So, like, that could extend into May. Honestly, as we sit here in mid-March, kind of funny to talk about, you know, things that might be happening in May, but this is the reality of starting pitching in baseball. This is why spring training is so long. It takes a long time to ramp these guys up and get them going and get them stretched out to haul innings. So, yeah, it's hard to imagine Alek Manoah making much of an impact in the first month of the season. On the Gausman side, I mean, he's going to throw a sim game on Wednesday, March 20th. Here in Florida, and so that's gonna be a two-up sim game, so that's probably around 40 pitches. So obviously, like, the first thing that has to happen is that has to go well. He has to feel good, and then he has to kind of bounce back and respond from it. And if all that goes well, okay, maybe he gets back on a mound 5 days later to try to get up to 55-60 pitches. So if he's going from Wednesday, I mean, we're now on into Monday that he would next be on a mound. Sunday, maybe Monday the 24th, 25th, up to 55-60 pitches. Does that go well? Okay, maybe he comes back the time after that and it's like 75. Now, the regular season has started by that point. So are you going to have him throwing 75 pitches for the first time this season in a regular season game? Maybe. He's a Cy Young finalist. He's really, really good. Maybe. But, and I tend to agree with you on this, seems unrealistic and it seems like a bit of a risk. And it seems like not only a risk, like, for him, just to throw him into that environment. Think about this. Like, he's going to throw a sim game on Wednesday. We still haven't seen him in an actual game against, like, competition wearing a different uniform. So his first time doing that is going to be late in spring training, like maybe the last game of spring. And then his second time doing that is going to be in a big league game that matters in an environment in probably Houston. Seems like a risk. Not only for him, but for the club as well. What that could mean for your bullpen if it goes disastrously, right? So it's seeming like I would put, you know, a 90% chance on this. Kevin Gausman opens the year on the IL and misses the first couple of weeks. I got to look up what the backdate day is. I haven't looked it up yet. But, you know, if you can backdate it, maybe he doesn't have to miss that much time. But yeah, he gets that, you know, 75 pitches under his belt, like that final ramp up outing, done at like extended or wherever you want him to do it. And then he can come back to the big leagues, you hope, optimistically, like 2 to 3 weeks into the season.
Yeah, I think that that's a far more realistic timeline. I think at this point, like, he's not going to open the season in the rotation. They are going to need five different starting pitchers who are not named Kevin Gausman, who are not named Alek Manoah. Like, that is just, it's, to me, that's a fact. To me, that's 100%. He cannot be one of the first five out of the gate, because at this point, you lined it up right there. It is just not possible. I mean, he said to you and I and a couple others, I forget exactly when, but it wasn't super long ago in Florida, that he wants to have a couple of outings in a game that doesn't count where he's up to 75 pitches. And even then, you know, 75 pitches, you know, we're not talking a full workload of a regular season game where, you know, they've pushed him to 107, 108 at times. But he says he needs to get at least to 75 pitches a couple times. So, you know, that could be, you know, for the first time, maybe that's March 30th. And then maybe the second time is April the 4th or 5th. Maybe he's back in a big league setting by something like April the 10th, that first home series of the season against the Seattle Mariners, or maybe against the Rockies. Like, that to me is a far more realistic timeline for Kevin Gausman. I just don't think it would be really fair to him or to your long-term and short-term and medium-term chances of competing against the best teams in baseball to just rush him like that. So, you know, agreed with you and the way you're outlining that, that it's far more likely this guy is starting the season in Florida somewhere, an extended spring, or, you know, maybe he gets up to AAA at some point for one of those rehab starts, but not in the rotation of the major league team.
And that would mean that your rotation for the Blue Jays to open the season would go Berríos, Bassett, Kikuchi, Francis, and then likely opener and Mitch White. Could be a straight start for Mitch White, but I feel like it would likely be opener and Mitch White, which is only going to put more stress and more toll on the bullpen, which, as we outlined earlier, has been taking some fire over the last week.
Yeah, it is a lot of pressure on that pitching staff. And, you know, especially you look at the competition, the quality of competition, it's really good. That's no secret. Rays, Astros, Yankees. You have one off day in the course of the first, you know, 13 games of the season. So it will be a lot of stress on this bullpen. And, you know, I think that it's going to be patchwork after the first few. Like, Berríos will get the chance to go six. Bassett will get the chance to go six. Yusei, I mean, we saw how they, you know, like to mix and match with him last year. You didn't see Yusei Kikuchi pitching the seventh a lot of games. You're not going to see Bowden Francis pitching in the sixth or seventh a lot early on. Mitch White, we might not see him in the fifth. So it's a lot on the bullpen.
You didn't see Yusei Kikuchi face the leadoff hitter a third time much at all. It wasn't until you know, later in the year that the Blue Jays started trusting him and to turn over a lineup two times and start his third trip through. And you're bang on about Francis. Like, that is two trips through and done. And with Mitch White, like, yeah, you might not see him in the first inning. Like, you might see Trevor Richards in the first inning, and then Mitch White takes over in the second. And it's sort of like it's, you know, ostensibly a bullpen day, really. But you hope that, like, Mitch White can carry you through. I will say, like, I, you know, it's very lonely for me here on Mitch White Island, right? Like, I see you all ashore, and I'm out here just like the one guy hanging out. But I look, man, he threw 70 pitches the other day, sat 97 throughout them, and had 18 whiffs. And I get it. Like, he needs to command his secondary stuff better. He needs to attack better. He needs to be better with two strikes and not to nibble and have his, you know, his breaking pitches carry the zone more. Like, absolutely, right? Like, there is a little bit of intent and mentality and mindset that needs to be adjusted there for him to be at his best. But, like, the stuff speaks for itself, man. Like, he, like, 18 whiffs in the 70 pitches, sitting 97, like, that does not grow on trees. So, like, there's something there. And we'll see if he can put it all together.
To the opposite field, the 0-2, swinging a foul tip, held on to for strike three. Fastball up the ladder, gets Gonzalez to chase for the first out of the inning.
A beautiful pitch there, tied him up.
Fastball. The other thing I wanted to comment on quickly, because, you know, you did mention, like, the Blue Jays have a really tough schedule to start the year. Like, yes, objectively, and you're going to hear a lot of people talking about this really tough schedule the Blue Jays have to start the year. But, like, when you play in the AL East, like, show me the schedule to start the year that is easy. Like, show me the version of the schedule where you open up against, like, Oakland, White Sox, Rockies. Like, it's just not going to happen. You play in the AL East, like, you're going to be, and you play in the American League, where there's a lot of good teams beyond just the East, but you play in the AL East, so you're always going to have some sort of playoff contender, tough lineup, like, you know, nails pitching staff out of the gates in one of those first two, three series, if not, you know, two out of three or all three. Like, you just, with the reality of this division in this league, the Blue Jays schedule is always going to be tough to start every season. That's just the construction of the sport.
It's a tough league. It's a really tough league. No question about that. Yeah, the Jays have a lot of adversity. I want to touch on one more challenge that they're facing connecting to the pitching staff, to the run prevention, before we maybe step aside and transition to some more positive storylines here. But this Good is luck. Another tough one, Danny. Yeah, I mean, it's... It's been a tough few days for these Jays. But Danny Jansen, another broken bone in his hand. This one expected to sideline him for at least a couple weeks. I mean, clearly he's not going to be ready on opening day. This opens the door for someone like Brian Servin, who has a really good defensive reputation. The Jays really like what he can do defensively. Maybe a Peyton Henry. You wrote about both these guys. You've talked to them in spring training. What's your read on the Jansen situation and where this leads the Jays?
Well, you just feel for Danny, like, this just that this keeps happening to him. And I don't need to tell anybody why this is an important year for Danny Jansen. But I mean, Danny Jansen is also just like such an important part of the Blue Jays, not only for the way that he handles the pitching staff, the trust the pitchers have in him, the trust that the coaching staff has in him, but also for what he could have brought offensively this year. Like, we've just seen these tantalizing glimmers of like what he could be with this approach that he's figured out over the last 12 to 18 months, where he was like, yeah, I'm just not gonna try to be this all fields guy that I'm never gonna be. I'm just gonna look for my pitch to pull, and I'm not gonna miss it, and I'm just gonna pull homers into the seats. And as a catcher, like, you can make a good living doing that. But you know, the other thing that Danny Jansen has shown over the last 12 to 18 months is that he hangs his hands out over the plate in order to execute that approach. And he catches some stray fire from pitchers occasionally. So just tough result for him. You know, it sounds like the news is as good as could possibly be. You know, if he's going to be able to restart baseball activity in a couple of weeks, like, this could have been a 6 to 8 week thing. We'll see. We'll see how this heals and what he's able to do. But, you know, hands obviously pretty important for catchers. But, you know, we'll see when he's able to come back. Yeah, in the meantime, a lot of Alejandro Kirk on the season opening road trip. And then, yeah, likely Brian Servin. I think that he's pretty much definitely going to be the secondary catcher. You know, I think that Peyton Henry is an interesting guy, and he makes, like, he's got a ton of raw power and makes really good contact, like, when he does make contact, but, like, just kind of actualizing it in games has sort of been his challenge, and he is not the defensive catcher that Brian Servin is. So, you know, like, a useful guy to have on hand, and somebody who I think can put some things together this year if he continues to kind of build on some of the gains that he made last year, when he was telling me, like, his approach and his swing really just kind of synced up, and he was really feeling good at the plate and understanding how to do his best in limited opportunities. He was in kind of a three-way playing time share in Nashville at AAA. But, you know, on Servin, like, this is a guy who internally, like, the Blue Jays are very high on his defense. Like, their internal defensive metrics feel like Servin could be like a one-win player in a secondary catcher's playing time. So we're talking, like, I don't know, 250 plate appearances or something, like a one-win player based just totally on his defense. So, like, that's optimistic, but, you know, that tells you why, like, the Blue Jays went out and got him, and I'm sure there's a reason why they feel that strongly about him and his receiving, his blocking, his game calling, his game management, controlling the running game, like, all these things. Like, this sounds like somebody who they really trust. I think the Blue Jays were pretty shocked to see him even get through waivers when they had to outright him basically on the eve of spring training. So it's going to be interesting to see him get his opportunity in the big leagues over the first week and see what he can do.
Yeah, a lot of defensive skill there. Like you said, the Jays really like that. So that's kind of what you look for, really, in a third catcher and a backup catcher. Jays often have had the luxury of more with Jansen, with Kirk, with Moreno for a brief time, but in this case, more that traditional backup role. And it's funny, they took him off the roster. Now they're going to have to get him back on. So someone else is going to have to come off to get one of these catchers, likely Servin, onto that roster, who knows what that looks like, but there are some decisions ahead for the Jays. And there also is some more good news with this team. So we will step aside. We will come back and talk about some of the more positive developments when we continue on At the Letters. Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Welcome back to At the Letters, second segment. This time, going to bring a little bit more positivity to the show. We're going to discuss Varsho, Vlad, some positional theories. I want to bounce off of you, Arden. We'll get to Joey Votto and hopefully have time to discuss some of the pitching developments around Major League Baseball as well. But okay, so we were just talking about the catching situation for this team, and I know there's some fans out there who look at Dalton Varsho, someone who's caught extensively in the major leagues, and they might think Dalton Varsho should be the guy who is backing up Alejandro Kirk at this point, and that is part of his utility as a major league player. And I wanted to just discuss that a little bit, at least to entertain the idea before we dismiss it or embrace it one way or the other. But, you know, to start this off, I'll say I don't really believe that that's a scenario that the Jays should pursue. But how do you look at this?
Yeah, I agree. And so if we're going to like take this down the road of something that should happen, like I need to know like what the like purpose of it is and like what the goal of it is. Like, is it to get more offense into the lineup? Like, why would somebody want like Dalton Varsho to be catching twice a week?
I think the theoretical argument that, again, I'm not personally making, but I think the theoretical argument is, okay, if you have Dalton Varsho catching twice a week, then that opens up left field. And so you're going to have Davis Schneider, let's say for argument's sake, playing left field. And now you have Davis Schneider in the lineup hitting seventh instead of Brian Servin hitting ninth.
I think that the defensive hit that you would take would just like far exceed any offensive upgrade that Davis Schneider could make on Brian Servin, or, you know, Kevin Biggio in the outfield on Brian Servin. If it was, you know, a righty on the mound and you wanted Biggio in there, I'd like just the demands of catching, like physically and mentally, are considerable. And it is just like, is the most important defensive position on the field. So I don't know that you want somebody in Dalton Varsho who hasn't done it regularly in three seasons. I'd have to look up like exactly when the last time he did it was. Like, I don't know that you just want to throw him back there and that you can just expect like to like, A, that it's just easy for him to assimilate, like reassimilate to being a catcher and to being behind the plate and game calling and dealing with all the demands and pre-game strategy sessions and understanding scouting reports and how you want to attack each hitter that comes to the plate and controlling the running game and managing you know, the pitch clock and your pitcher and everything that goes into being a big league catcher, receiving, blocking, dealing with umpires. I could go on. Like, it's not easy to do that. And then you would just take such a defensive hit, and having somebody in there who is just not up to speed in all of those elements, like, I just think that would really wear on your pitching staff and your run prevention. And there's just, you know, Davis Schneider would have to hit like three grand slams to make up for it.
And what happens if Dalton Varsho takes a foul ball off of his wrist, right, when he's catching, and then all of a sudden you're down a left fielder and a catcher? I just think, you know, agree with the points you make there. And I think that the risk is just way too high. And the offensive upgrade that you're going to get with a Davis Schneider, yeah, it's not going to make up for it. So to me, I think Varsho is essentially an emergency catcher only. Like, I think it's almost like with Josh Donaldson when he was a Blue Jay going back, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. At that point, yeah, he had caught in the major leagues, just like Dalton Varsho had. And Josh Donaldson at one point was a catcher for the Oakland A's. But you just don't want to take that kind of risk with a player who's that important. And granted, Varsho isn't an MVP, but he was like a 5-win player last year, and he might be a 5-win player for this team again. So we're talking about someone who's a very, very important piece of this team. I just don't think you mess with it.
Well, yeah, and you remove like the biggest contributor to that war total, which is his outfield defense. You know, right. It's like you're going to remove that 2 or 3 times a week. Like, that's last season. I mean, that was the like most impactful thing he brought to the team, was the defense he played in the outfield. Literally, probably the best outfield defender in baseball. So I don't know that you'd want to take that hit. And it's also not like Brian Servin is just an automatic out at the plate. Like, he's a catcher, certainly. So, you know, I don't think he's going to be Johnny Bench. But, like, this is somebody who can run into one. This is somebody who can hit the ball very hard. He worked over the offseason with Craig Wallenbrock, who is, like, this legendary MLB hitting guru, somebody who helped, like, J.D. Martinez unlock himself a number of years ago, has worked with a ton of big leaguers. He was a hitting consultant for the Dodgers at one time, I believe. Like, they did a ton of work on his swing path and on, you know, just getting some more out of the contact that he makes. And lo and behold, like, Servin's average exit velo this spring, for what it's worth, in spring on, you know, whatever it is, 15 to 20 balls in play, is up over 97 miles per hour. Like, he's been tagging pitches this spring. He hit a bomb off Bailey Ober the other day that was like over 108 off his bat. So, you know, I'm not saying Brian Servin is going to be the best offensive catcher in baseball. He's probably going to be in a below average offensive contributor, but he is someone who can run into one and who can hit the ball very hard and probably clear the fences here and there. His first two hits in the big leagues were both two run home runs hit in the same game. So it's somebody who can run into one. It's not like he's a total zero. I just think that the defensive downside would way outweigh the offensive upside of, you know, having like a Davis Schneider in the lineup over a Brian Servin.
Agreed. And I think, you know, you make a good point about the value that Varsho brings in left field, right? Like, if you could have Kevin Kiermaier catch, well, okay, sure, but then you're losing out on his center field defense. So at a certain point, you're shuffling the pieces around. It doesn't actually accomplish anything. Sounds like we're both agreed on that. And the Blue Jays are too. We're not going to see Dalton Varsho catching. So, all right, that brings us to another defensive scenario I want to run past you. And this one I actually do kind of believe the Jays should do. They don't agree with me on this, so I'm curious to hear where you stand. But Vlad Guerrero Jr., he is someone who has played third base in the major leagues. I'm not saying he becomes your everyday third baseman. I'm not saying anything like that. But is there a scenario, as you see it, where, and again, the Blue Jays aren't going to do this, it seems, but do you think that there's a case to be made, maybe a case to be made for the Blue Jays to consider this more strongly than they have, of having Vlad Jr. take some more ground balls at third base and just get ready to be capable at that position, whether it's late in games, whether it's mixed in for an occasional start at that position? Because honestly, I do see that case.
Late in games, I can get there. If it's extra innings, you made a bunch of moves, if, you know, you're just kind of in a situation with your roster where, like, it just makes the most sense to have him move over to third base for the ninth or the 10th or the 11th, play an inning or two there, like, fine. And I actually think that would be on the table, like, if it came to that. But I'm not starting Vladimir Guerrero Jr. at third base. Like, with everything that he's trying to achieve this year offensively, and at the plate, like, with all the things he's been working on, with, like, how much he needs to focus on the most important thing he brings to this club, which is the four or five times he goes to the plate, I'm not asking him to take on that challenge of having to play third base and having to deal with, like, the inevitable miscues and errors that will be committed. And just, I'm not putting that mental stress on him at this time. He's so important to my lineup offensively. I want him playing somewhere where he's comfortable, where it's, you know, nothing in baseball is automatic, but it is, like, as autopilot as it can be, and he can just focus on his swing and executing against big league pitching.
That's a reasonable take, and I think that, you know, clearly the decision makers in the Blue Jays organization agree with you. So there are a lot of people who are on that same page. To me, the way I look at it is, okay, you have spring training, it's 6 weeks, right? You have all this time, and I actually look at it as you could use some of that time to just get him acclimated to the position in a way that they haven't done it. And you could just have him take more ground balls there regularly. Like, we see Turner taking ground balls at third base, at second base, at first base. He's not going to be an everyday second baseman for this team, but he takes ground balls there just in case. I think you could do the same thing with Vlad Jr. and maybe even have him start a couple spring games there to see if he can't get ready for that position. And then, hey, if it proves to be too challenging, if he's down there in Bradenton playing against the Pirates and he boots four balls, okay, you scrap the plan. He's not ever going to play third base. That's fine. But if he's comfortable there, there's no downside, or I should say very, very little downside to easing him in this sort of spring setting, because who knows what happens, right? maybe George Springer ends up with hamstring tightness and you want him to be DHing, okay? And it's April the 15th. And maybe you want to have Joey Votto and Justin Turner and Vlad Guerrero Jr. in the lineup at the same time. You want to have that offense, but Springer's taking up the DH spot. Well, you could do that if Vladdy is capable of playing third base. Votto's at first, maybe Turner's a second for that day. It's not an everyday thing, but that would be the sort of thing that to me would be really interesting, and it's hard to do out of nowhere in the middle of the season. So I actually think that it would have been really interesting to see them do that in spring as an experiment to see if you could open some doors for yourself in season.
It's hard to do for the first time in, what, 5 years, right? Because it was 2019 was the last time he was a regular third baseman, because in 2020 he turned up in poor condition and the Blue Jays didn't play him at that position anymore, and then he became a full-time first baseman from there. So 2019 was the last, like 5 years ago was the last time the Vladimir Guerrero Jr. played third base. I don't know that there's enough reps you could get him in spring to get him to a point where he would be feeling like fully comfortable there with like the intensity and pace of a big league environment with like actual regular season games that matter, when there's balls coming off of bats at 108 miles per hour at you and you got a runner going to second base and you got to make like a split second decision and you got to have a clock and you've got the intensity and you've got the third deck and you've got all these people watching you and all of that pressure. Like, I'm just not putting that on Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And I just don't think that you could get him to a place with, a couple of spring games where the other thing, like, I don't want to put the additional physical toll on him of that. Like, this is someone who's already had a couple of nagging injuries through spring, somebody who we know has been playing hurt at least through last year, and I would wager through the last couple of seasons, like battling some of these sort of nagging injuries in his lower half. I don't know that I want him like playing a more defensively, physically demanding position, because like I said, it's his most important, like his most valuable contribution to the Blue Jays. It's kind of like how Varsho's most valuable contribution is in the outfield. Vlad's most valuable contribution is as your three-hole hitter, and that's what I want him focusing on, is getting back to like the MVP level offensive contributor that he's been prior. The other thing is, you're taking like a pretty serious defensive hit by putting him at third. This isn't like, you know, at first base he's a below average defender. The last time he played third 5 years ago, he's a below average defender. So you have to assume that like you're not going to have great defense at third, and you got a pitching staff with five starters for whom the ball is in play a great deal.
Yeah, those are valid points. Those are valid points. And no doubt they contribute to why the Blue Jays land where you do on this. To me, I just look at it, I'm like, 6 weeks, man, that's a long time. You can do a lot of different things, and it's not going to take that much of a toll to have Vladdy take some ground balls there in a couple spring, you know, mornings and the occasional Grapefruit League game. I do admit, if you're rolling out an infield where it's like Votto at first and Vladdy at third, maybe even a Turner at second, like, you're not talking about a great defensive infield right there. You start to, you know, take some serious hits. But to me, it's just about the versatility. And where Varsho, to me, that's like a bridge too far. That's where it's like, it's true emergency. But Vladdy's a 25-year-old athlete. And, you know, I'm not saying he's Mookie Betts, but he is a guy who could definitely do it. In my mind, he is a good enough athlete to do it. I think that, again, I know the Jays disagree with me, but I actually think that this would be a really nice way to add a little more flexibility for that. You know, you're on the West Coast, you got a day game after a night game, something comes up, you can't fly someone in time. That's, to me, like, this could be a situation where it just helps you out with a little bit extra options.
Yeah, I'm not comfortable with the risk personally, but I am comfortable with weirdness. So, like, sign me up for the super weird alignment where, yeah, Varsho behind the plate, Votto at first, Turner at second, Bo and Vlad, you got like Davis Schneider in left, George Springer's carrying a nagging injury, so you got like Kevin Biggio in right, and Kevin Kiermaier's playing center, but then he like runs into a wall and bangs his elbow or something and has to come out of the game, and now all of a sudden like you're having to make all kinds of other maneuvers, and you know, IKF is now behind the plate because Varsho had to go out to center. Yeah, sign me up for the weirdness. I'm here for that. But I just don't see Vladimir Guerrero Jr. making a start at third base.
Yeah, it seems very unlikely. But within a lot of what I was outlining there, I was making some presumptions, of course, and that one of those presumptions was that Joey Votto would be on this team. And we are a long way from that. at this point as we record this on March 19th. However, as I see it, I mean, he's only faced one pitch in Grapefruit League competition, but he's off to a pretty good start because that pitch was a Zach Wheeler fastball that he was able to turn around and send to the opposite field over the wall in Clearwater and hit it for a home run. So when I'm looking at Joey Votto, everything that we've seen from him so far, to me, paints the picture of someone who might actually have a chance to contribute in a meaningful way offensively. I'm not saying 30 bombs. I'm not saying MVP caliber. Let's look at the month of April. Could he be a good major league hitter at some point in the month of April? I actually think he could.
First pitch from Wheeler. Hit in the air to left center field. Pache again. It's going to be over his head, and it's off the top of the wall. Nope, now they're going to call a home run. They're going to say a home run for Joey Votto in his first spring training at bats. How about that on the first pitch he saw?
Do we know it went over the wall? Do we have confirmation on that?
It was pretty close. I mean, he definitely hit that one hard. It was pretty good contact. Zach Wheeler is someone who's as good as it gets on a major league mound. To me, that is actually significant. It's proof of concept of something significant.
I think that, yeah, Zach Wheeler, when he's like 96, 97 and living to the edges and like executing a plan, setting up his stuff effectively in the regular season and certainly into the playoffs. Yes, I think Zach Wheeler is one of the best pitchers in baseball. Zach Wheeler in Clearwater facing a future Hall of Famer, a legend who he's aware is taking his first plate appearance of the spring and who he's aware is trying to make a team, laying in a 94 mile per hour first pitch cookie, like right down the heart of the plate. And Joey Votto perhaps anticipating that that is what's going to happen because Joey is an incredibly smart hitter and knows exactly what is going on. Perhaps cheats a little bit to that pitch and, you know, perhaps anticipates that fastball and all over it and tags it, shades of Troy Tulowitzki off of Marcus Stroman back in the day. So I think that everybody is rooting for Joey Votto, right? Like everybody wants this to work out because it's an exceptional story. Our bias as journalists is that it's great to have Joey Votto around. He's just, yeah, you know, an amazing fountain of insight and knowledge and sound bites. He's going to make our jobs a lot easier throughout the season. And like, who wouldn't love the story of him after like two really down years, really challenging years with his health, proving that he can still be that dude again, that in his words, he can still bang. Like, how amazing would that story be if he had this like Pujols-esque season, right? Where in like, you know, one of the last years of his career into his 40s, you know, he gets back to that like whatever you want to say, 120, 125 WRC plus guy. I don't think Votto's ever going to get back to peak Votto, but being like a very productive big leaguer at this point in his career, considering like the feedback he's received from the game over the last couple of years. Yeah, what an amazing story. Who wouldn't want to see that? One pitch into his attempt, he is off to a very good start. Let's just see how maybe the second pitch goes and maybe the 10th pitch and the 50th pitch and the 100th pitch.
Yeah, there's more to prove for sure. I like that Pujols comp. I looked it up just now. This is wild. Pujols was in his age 42 season. This is only a couple years ago. It feels like longer. In 2022, he hit 24 home runs and he had a 151 OPS plus. I mean, that is absolutely wild that he was able to do that. I think that's beyond what anyone would expect for Joey Votto. But honestly, like, he's a Hall of Fame caliber hitter too. I just wouldn't be surprised if Joey Votto, again, month of April, could he have an 830 OPS and hit four bombs? Could he go into May and have an 810 OPS and hit six doubles? Like, I actually think he could. I liked what I saw from him on the backfields. Obviously, that one swing against Wheeler. We're dealing with small samples here. I understand, like, if you're facing the double-A pitchers from the Detroit Tigers, you should look like a Hall of Famer. Like, that's the baseline. That's not necessarily, you know, proof of anything. But I do think it shows that he's healthy, trending in the right direction. And, yeah, there's more to prove. But I don't know. Maybe he's washed. Maybe he's done. And I won't be shocked if we never see a productive Joey Votto month again. But I could really see this being something. And this is why I actually think, like, when I look at this offense of this team, I think it's a good offensive team. And it's just kind of weird because we talk so much about the pitching questions in the first segment, but I look at the offense and like they're in a good spot to score a bunch of runs, I think.
So if Votto does like make the team, it's not going to be for opening day, right? Like it's going to be midway through April sort of deal. Like he just doesn't have enough runway to get up to speed. I would be very surprised if he is with the Blue Jays on opening day. I think he'll likely be, he'll be extended, or if he wants to go out to, you know, one of the affiliates and like there's, you know, he's going to take a bit more time. Even if he is back, it's going to take a bit more time. So you said this is a good offensive team. Let's say your opening day batting order is Springer, Bichette, Vlad, Turner, and then you go one of the catchers. Well, actually, Danny Jansen's hurt, so it's going to be Kirk or Varsho. Maybe you want the lefty in there. So you go like Varsho or Kirk and Varsho, and then the bottom third is going to be some combination of Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, Kevin Biggio, and Kevin Kiermaier. You think that is a good offensive team?
Yeah, I think
we shall see. We shall see.
what's your confidence level in that group?
I think that it's like a similar offensive team to what it was last year. Like a team that could be towards the back of the top 10. And maybe that is a good offensive team, right? To me, I would say like, and it's semantics, right? But I would say above average, certainly. But like, I don't know that as presently constructed, this is like a top 5 to 7 or even 8 offensive team. And that's where I would say kind of like the cutoff is for good.
And I think, you know, Jays fans have seen some just elite offenses over the years, right? Whether it's Bautista, Encarnacion, Donaldson, Russ Martin, and Colabello, like those teams were so, so stacked offensively. Then even more recently, 2021, you have Vladdy going off. You have Bo, you have Marcus Semien setting the record for home runs in a single season by a second baseman. Like the bar has been set super, super high here. I'm not predicting that, of course, but compared to last year, I think they can be better. I think that you take that starting nine that you just outlined, then eventually, I don't think it'll take too long. Maybe it's 10 days into the season. You have Joey Votto feeling healthy, and he's in that lineup as a bench player. You have David Schneider coming off the bench if you want. You have Ernie Clement potentially. You have Danny Jansen eventually returning. I see this as a good offensive team. I may potentially a very good offensive team and potentially a team that could be one of the top 5 to 7 in Major League Baseball. Now, it's not a guarantee, and they have a lot of work to do to get to that point, but I wouldn't say that about every Major League team. Like, I don't think that the East is pretty stacked, but I mean, clearly, like, the Royals, the Royals don't have that upside. Yeah. Yeah. But even the Red Sox, actually, the Red Sox, if Trevor Story is going off, like, they could be a good, really good offensive team. But, like, okay, the Mets. Like, the Blue Jays are a better offense than the Mets. They're a better offense than, you know, the Cardinals, in my opinion. And these are contending teams. I'm not just trying to cherry pick the worst teams in baseball. So this is where I actually see, like, some real, you know, upside here with this group.
I think they're in that, like, 8 to 12 range. You know, 12 in, like, a really bad scenario and 8 in a better, you know, if you're getting some better outcomes and some better luck. So, like, I don't think that there's enough, like, high-end talent for them to, like, push into the top 5 unless, like, Vlad's going to have this renaissance season and you know, Votto's gonna have the Pujols year. Maybe that's, you know, maybe this is another conversation. And you know, George Springer is gonna have like that one more peak year, but you know, the back half of you know, George Springer's deal with the Blue Jays, it's kind of hard for me to imagine that there's another 140 WRC plus year in there. I think it can be better than last year, but I don't know that there's another like peak Springer year in there. With Votto, as you said, like, we're making a lot of assumptions based off of one pitch and some swings off of minor leaguers. You know, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. has a lot to prove this year. Very important year for him. So I just don't think there's enough certainty there for me to say that this is like a top 5 team and, you know, one of the better offenses in baseball.
If Springer doesn't have another big year with the Jays, then that's a pretty middling contract. We will see. We will see. You know, he certainly has the potential and the track record of doing more. Okay, one other thing I want to bounce off you before we step away here. But, you know, speaking of where the Blue Jays stack up, it's all a relative thing, right? And every time that a prominent player lands, with a team outside of the American League East, that's probably a good thing for the Jays. So I think it's probably worth mentioning that Blake Snell with the Giants could have gone to the Yankees. They reportedly offered him a pretty big deal not that long ago. And Dylan Cease, that's a player that the Yankees were said to be pursuing. He was also linked to the Orioles at various points this offseason. Cease goes to the Padres. I really like that move for AJ Preller and the Padres. And then Snell on the Giants, who really have continued adding and adding. So pretty big moves for the National League West. We're not like dialed in on the NL West here on ATL necessarily. But I think it does have an implication for the Blue Jays and probably a positive one.
Yeah, it's anytime that those guys aren't going to be in your division. That's helpful. I still do think there's like a pretty good likelihood that Jordan Montgomery ends up in division, whether it's with the Red Sox or the Yankees. So, there's still that to come. But yeah, after a winter of seeing like Juan Soto come into division and the Yankees load up, I think that you're pretty happy as a Blue Jays fan that they didn't also add Blake Snell.
Anything else that we want to get to here before we step aside and let you get back to the rest of your duties down in Florida here?
I have one more, but it has to be the last thing that we talk about. Because the thing I'm going to talk about, like, people are just going to like turn off the podcast. So get to it.
I do not have anything else. You do have my attention now that you've set it up that way. And I suspect our listeners are very intrigued as well.
Paulo Espino.
There we go.
The man.
Swing and a miss. Allen went fishing after a breaking ball in the dirt. Espino has struck out three batters in a row.
Everybody ready for the Paulo Espino segment? This is probably the only time that we're going to talk about Paulo Espino all year. If we are talking about him in a meaningful way this year, something has gone seriously awry for the Blue Jays. But I'm writing about him this week, and it's like every spring I find one story that I just love and that is just like reignites my love of baseball and like puts aside all of the kind of like bitter and resentful things that come with, the sport and just the way that it works and everything. Like getting to chat with Paulo Espino, man, like what a dude. This guy's 37. This guy didn't make his big league debut until he was 30. He spent like 11 years in the minor leagues, fought his way to the big leagues at 30 with Milwaukee, had like a cup of coffee that season, then went back to the minors for three more seasons and fought his way back again with the Washington Nationals, who he pitched with for the last 4 years. And the ERA is not great. Like the numbers are pretty salty. And the Nationals used Paulo Espino as just like, they just had no regard for his arm and well-being whatsoever. Like they just used him as this like anytime, anywhere dude. It was like, you are coming out of the bullpen this week and mopping up, and then next week you are making spot starts in a rotation, and the week after that you're like back to the bullpen and pitching on back-to-back days, and then 48 hours after that you're taking over for the injured starter in the first inning and like throwing 48 pitches and getting us into the fifth. And like Espino is just like such a beauty and such a selfless dude that he just takes it all on because he's just loves baseball so much that he just wants to be in this sport so badly that he is like, yeah, I will do literally anything. And this is what he's told the Blue Jays as well, is like, I will do anything, whatever you need me to do, bullpen, start, AAA, majors, long outings, short outings, anything you want, like I will do it. And it's one of the reasons why he's stuck around for as long as he has. Like I said, he's 37. He was drafted in 2006. Like the only dudes remaining from his draft class are Clayton Kershaw and Max Scherzer, Hall of Famers. Like everyone else is gone, retired, whether like willingly or not. Like the fact that Espino is still getting opportunities is just like, it is such a testament to his like resolve and to like his dedication to this game. By the way, not exactly a guy who is blowing anyone away. His fastball is 88. Like this is a guy who has survived as a professional pitcher for going into his 18th season with an 88 mile per hour fastball because he throws this like ridiculous low 70s 12-6 curveball that like drops 70 inches on its way to the plate. Like it makes Chris Bassett's curveball look like a fastball. Like this thing is like so slow and so loopy, but nobody can make contact with it because he sets it up really well with an 88 mile per hour fastball. And he just commands this pitch so well. He's like spins the crap out of it, like among the highest spin rates in baseball, throws strikes, doesn't walk anybody, takes the ball whenever you want. This guy, like he has pitched winter ball like the last 11 years because like this is just how dedicated to his craft he is. And also, by the way, like this is his job.
Probably
and,
you know, the money.
100%, dude. Like he's got two young kids, one's in kindergarten, the other's in first grade, and like his wife's a stay-at-home mom. So like he's like and you know, you don't spend like he's probably got, I don't know, 2 years of big league service maybe, right? Like you don't spend as much time in the minors as he does and get rich. So like he is absolutely like he's going and think about the sacrifice, right? With a young family of having to go to winter ball like every year. This guy is from Panama. He was telling me like he hasn't been home to see his parents in over a year. Like his parents haven't seen their grandchildren in over a year because like he is just he just goes from job to job to job. Like at the end of last season, he had a tendon injury in his hand, in his ring finger. Like he was having trouble gripping the ball and like honestly just like throwing it. He was pitching through it, didn't say anything, but it just got so bad that, you know, the Nationals had to take him off their staff and they released him because they needed the 40-man roster spot. He went like straight into rehabbing this thing. He probably needs surgery, but like he's not gonna get it at this stage in his career. He can't miss a year. Like he can't miss time when you're 37 at this stage. So he just like got a bunch of cortisone shots, did a bunch of rehab on it just to regain extension and get it to a point where he can throw the ball again, and then went straight into the Dominican Winter League this winter, and at 37, had the third most innings in Lidón in the Dominican Winter League, led all qualified pitchers in ERA and WHIP, was just like carving dudes in the Dominican this winter. And then like his final Dominican start was January 16th. He was in Blue Jays camp like 2 days later. Like he just like came back to Florida and went straight into Blue Jays camp. Like I loved getting to learn his story and getting to write about it. I could go on for about 20 more minutes. This is why I said it had to be the last thing that we had to talk about. It's going to be at sportsnet.ca later this week. Paulo Espino is a dude, and I'm grateful to him for the time that he gave me recently to get to tell his story. And it's the kind of spring stories that I love telling every year.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. That's a super fun one. You know, this guy is a professional baseball player. You know, to hear you describe that, like this is his profession. He needs to go and find teams that want him to play baseball because that's just what he does. That's really cool. And it's also, it's such a contrast, right, to how carefully managed the likes of a Ricky Tiedemann, you know, these young pitching prospects are when they come up. Understandably so, you know, they have long careers ahead of them. Ricky Tiedemann, 21 years old. And then you get to Paulo. It's kind of like they just have no regard for his arm. And, you know, of course, it's not quite that bad. They give him the resources to be in big league spring training and have access to these recovery, you know, systems and everything else. And no one wants him to get injured. But there's a subtext here that no one's really saying that it's pretty clear they don't have the same regard for his arm that they would for a Ricky Tiedemann. And there's something, it's like very throwback. And I think that I'm not saying it's good. It's just the way it is when you have a 37-year-old who's throwing 88. Like you said, he's not going to go get TJ and be away from baseball for 12 to 18 months. He's going to pitch one way or another. And so the Jays now are the beneficiaries of that kind of willingness to take the ball whenever he's needed.
It's a tough way to make a living, man. And like, you're right. Like the Nationals, they used him as a means to an end because like he wasn't on the 2019 Nationals when they won a World Series. No. He was on the, you know, 2021 Nationals and the 2022 Nationals, you know, seasons in which like he threw over 100 innings for those teams. But I mean, you know, the Nationals weren't trying to be good. You know, Washington was, you know, they weren't exactly trying to be the most competitive team in baseball. And yeah, they used Espino as like basically just like this innings vacuum. I think it was like 21, I think his debut like his debut of the season was like a last minute emergency spot start because Steven Strasburg got hurt. And then from there, like he bounced between, you know, rotation and bullpen, spot start here, mop up relief there, pitch on back to back days here. And then like all of a sudden he had to come in for Max Scherzer, who got hurt one batter into an outing, and like, just, you know, 2 days after he had last pitched, and then just like carried the ball through the fifth, like shutout innings. And then, you know, 2 weeks after that, he's starting on short rest. Like there was one that I looked up, just looking at his game logs was like so eye-opening and distressing, honestly. Like just seeing like some of the times that he would go like five innings and then like 48 hours later he would come out of the bullpen and throw like 50 pitches. Like it was just crazy the way that this guy was being used. Like it's a tough way to make a living, but like it really it says something about like about his resolve, like his perseverance, his dedication, like how much he loves this game, like how much he loves this craft. Like the fact that with his stuff, like at his age, that he's still doing it with, you know, how challenging it's been for him to stay at this level. You know, he's in like his sixth big league organization with the Blue Jays. He's played winter ball in like in three different leagues. Like I said, 11 years in winter ball. He's represented Panama at WBC. Like anytime anyone has asked this guy to take the ball and pitch, like he has. So, you know, we don't talk about guys like that enough because they are, you know, circulating, like they are hovering throughout this game that really does like kind of, you know, chew them up and spit them out. And I just think it's really cool that, you know, what he's drafted in 2006, that he's still out here doing it. And watch, he's going to have like some really good outings for Buffalo. Like he's like, even the spring, he struck out like a third of the batters that he's faced. Like the stuff plays. You know, I don't think that it would play, you know, in the big leagues reliably, but I think that like with Buffalo, I think that you'll see him pitching like six inning shutouts every once in a while because it's just a day where like the curveball is spinning like crazy, you know, which makes the fastball play up, and he locates so well and sequences so well and just keeps hitters off balance so well. Like he's going to have good outings for the Bisons this year for sure.
Just to your point about the rest, I brought up his career splits here, and he's got two starts on 2 days rest in his career, as well as one start on 3 days rest. So that tells you, I mean, 2 days rest, that is just like, that's ridiculous.
There was a season where I was looking this up where he like finished as many games as he started. And it was like the numbers were like in the 30s, you know, like it was crazy. Like find me another pitcher who has like 30 plus like starts and 30 plus finishes. Or it might have been like over his time with the Nationals, like it's something like that, right? Where it's just like, find me another guy who is just used in such a wide variety of roles. He has a save. Like he freaking closed a game for Washington because their bullpen was burned out, came in for the ninth against the Phillies and like went through Harper, Real Muto. And, you know, it was probably like Hoskins, Harper, Real Muto, something like that. This is pre-Schwarber days, and just like went through the heart of the Phillies order and saved a game. Like he has done everything.
Well, Romano down, Gausman down. Maybe Espino just covers for both. Just covers for everyone. He can do it all. We'll see if he ends up making an appearance. I'd say he's got a pretty good shot at some point this season. But we'll look out for your story coming up in a couple of days at sportsnet.ca. Anything else? You said that was the last thing. Anything else you want to get to before we step away here?
As I said, there's nowhere else to go after the Paulo Espino diatribe.
We will leave it there in that case for this episode of At the Letters. Thanks for sticking with us this week and throughout the entire spring training. We'll have another episode next week, of course, to set up the regular season. But that is it for us right now. For Arden Zwelling and producers Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade, I'm Ben Nicholson-Smith. Thank you so much for listening to At the Letters.